biologist at the University of Kansas.
So these are Sara Lee's boys?
That's right.
Sons?
To her two sons.
Uh-huh.
Brother Jim is a high school teacher, as he has been for a lifetime, in El Cajon, California. He married a Swiss school teacher whom he met at the University of Paris, and they have three children, one of whom, a son, is a Foreign Service officer, and a daughter who is a journalist for the Colorado newspaper, and another daughter who is teaching physiotherapy in San Diego.
And you and the dad are both gone, as are my folks.
Yes,
uh-huh.
Yes.
And I think some of our recent arrivals in the Tulare County area need to be reminded that the park that's named in the honor of the Zumwalt family is in remembrance of your dad, as well as is of recognition of the Admiral.
Yes, it was a wonderful thing for me to have my dad really be the primary honoree at the time of the naming of the park and of that wonderful episode when some 3,000 or 4,000 people gathered to honor him, and I came home for it.
Your father was also Elmo?
Elmo R.
So that's how come your grandson is the fourth.
Right.
And your dad's tour of duty was with the Army.
Served in both World War I. He was discharged as a captain in the Medical Corps and then went back as a major in World War II and came out a full colonel after having commanded a combat field hospital in World War II.
I think our listeners ought to be reminded, and for the recent arrivals, be told about your father's leadership role here, too.
Dad was mayor of the city when he came back from World War II. He served on both grammar school and high school boards for many years. He served in a large number of civic fields and was one of those kind who served as sort of doctor and father confessor for three generations of families and so on.
The times that I've thought about your dad during the struggle to try to keep the hospital open gave me a lot of courage. We lost the battle finally, but
I'm sorry to hear that. I didn't know it had happened then.
It's an active clinic doing a good job, but the county simply decided finally to go out of the acute care inpatient business and maintain clinics throughout the county, and then contract for that inpatient mm-hmm. services, which may have been a good decision. Do you remember our discussions with Dr. Kahn?
Yes, I do, in connection with preparing for a debate on socialized medicine.
I thought about that a few times, too, during this current discussions of Health Systems Agency and HMOs and all this business.
I can remember my dad was quite worried that socialized medicine was just around the corner. One of the reasons he persuaded me to go to the Naval Academy instead of becoming a doctor like my mother and father.
You're back in the medical field, though, aren't you now? Connected with a firm that deals in medical capital investments and so forth?
Yes, I've been a director for 6 years of a firm called American Medical Buildings, Inc., which designs for a guaranteed price medical facilities below the level of hospitals. And about 5 weeks ago, the board asked me to take over as chairman and chief executive officer, which I agreed to do for an interim period of time to try to get things back on track and then bring in someone who can stay on longer than I'm willing to stay.
Well, you had helped organize the company or been affiliated with the company prior, hadn't you?
I put in nearly 3 years as chairman, as president and CEO, 1977 and 1980. And then left to come back and work for the defeat of Mr. Carter and the election of Mr. Reagan.
Then I guess the company had some leadership problems, so they called you back again. I saw the article in the Wall Street Journal, incidentally, which is where I got that clue that you were back with the firm. So we can tell your dad when we report in one of these days that you did get back into the medical field eventually anyhow. There are some youngsters out in our audience that are currently enrolled at Wilson School and at our elementary schools. Wasn't Wilson School one of your...
Yes, Don, you and I were together there in kindergarten in the first grade, and then we suddenly discovered in my family that it was a shorter walk to Roosevelt, so I shifted to the other side until we joined up again in the sixth grade.
That's right. Your parents and your family lived on,
On 8th Street.
8th Street, right across from the church.
Yes, my wife Musa and I drove by there just today to take a look at the house. It's in quite a state of disrepair, but it brought back a lot of memories.
Still there, and so is the home to which you moved later on Sycamore.
Right, 854 Sycamore, and still, we drove by that one too, and it looks very, very fine.
The people who have been subsequent owners of that house have had the same respect for it as did you, and it shows.
It sure shows a lot of love.
Then we both came out of Tulare High School. Then after you left high school, on to the Naval Academy, am I recalling right, with a brief stay at Rutherford?
Yeah, I did a year at Rutherford Prep School down in Long Beach, and then entered the class of 43 in June of 1939 at the Naval Academy.
And they stepped up those classes, did they not? Because the war had started, and they wanted you out there on the
right. My class was the first three-year class. Graduated therefore in June of 1942, just in time for my classmates and I to get out into the Guadalcanal campaign. And tragically, after some 75 of us had proceeded together down toward the Solomons on a transport, we were broken up and got to our respective ships just before the campaign, and a few weeks later a significant number of them were dead from those actions and had ships named after them within a year after graduation.
Well, no class certainly had the immediate exposure, I guess, in all history than that class of 43 from the academy. Am I remembering right that your first assignment was in destroyers?
Yes, I went to the USS Phelps, and as I recall, you and I crossed paths in your similar naval experience.
I think we saw one another in Hawaii briefly after Guadalcanal.
At which time you were on a cruiser,
as I recall. Huh? And then I guess I didn't see you again until we happened to be back in Tulare on some occasion. But then I guess following World War II, your career was meteoric. It just seemed like every time I heard something out of Washington, Admiral Officer Zumwalt had moved up. When was it that you? Let's fill in some gaps that even I don't remember, but. At the end of World War II, where were you, what were you doing, and what was your assignment, what was your rank?
Well, I ended up the war as a lieutenant, as did all my class, and I served the entire war on destroyers. At the end of the war, my destroyer captured a Japanese gunboat, the HIJMS Ataka, a 1,200-ton gunboat, trying to escape from the Yangtze River. I was put on board and made the prize crew officer with two younger officers and 10 sailors with 200 Japanese crew. We found the charts to the minefields of the Yangtze River and got permission to take it up the river to Shanghai, where at a dinner party on the 1st of October I met Amusa Coutelet de Rocher. 7 days later I proposed, and 22 days later from the day of the meeting we were married. She's here with me today and is the mother of our four children.
Fantastic. That is one of the stories I hadn't heard. I knew Musa hadn't originated in this country, but I wasn't just sure how you made that connection. Obviously, you couldn't put her aboard and bring her home. How did all this come about?
Well, we did the next best thing. I left in December of 1945, and in March of 1946, the Army was gracious enough to let her come back on board an Army transport, along with a number of Army wives who had married GIs overseas. And so she joined me in Charleston as I then proceeded through tours as an executive officer of a couple of destroyers. And then, having moved 12 times in our first 2 years of married life, we had a wonderful respite where I taught for 2 years at the University of North Carolina in the NROTC. And that's where the second of our four children was born.
I guess that it will always be the history of people who dedicate their lives to the service, that constant moving around, and one of the things you have to put up with. But it appears to me that you haven't really settled down much even after you left the Navy. But before getting into your current life, who was the commander-in-chief? Who was the president at the time you became chief of naval operations?
It was Mr. Nixon, whom I had never met until the night before the announcement of my appointment. I think my real sponsor was Melvin Laird, who was then Secretary of Defense, who had met me when he came out to Vietnam for briefings from General Abrams, and at that time I was General Abrams' principal naval commander. So that was the story of how that came about.
Does the assignment as one of the chiefs of staff, in your case the chief of naval operations, run for a fixed term?
Yes, it's a 4-year term by statute, and very wisely, I think, the Congress has provided that you cannot be reappointed after a single term. That's unlike the chairman, who is appointed for 2 years and can be reappointed. And the theory of the difference is that the chairman must be more responsive politically to the president and to the Congress, whereas the Congress wants the service chiefs of staff to have the independence of knowing that it's a one-time experience and they should call them exactly as they see them.
Mm-hmm. Is the matter of the selection of that representative on the Joint Chiefs that acts as the chairman, is that the presidential...
Traditionally, the president makes the decision to do it. He's subject, of course, as are the service chiefs of staff, to confirmation by the president. In some cases, the Secretary of Defense has almost complete control because the president delegates it to him. In others, the president makes a very personal choice.
That brings up the next question. It's never been clear in my mind that the relationship between the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense.
Well, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, by law, are the military advisors to both the Secretary of Defense and the President, which means that that they have a very special responsibility, if the Secretary of Defense doesn't agree with them, to ensure that their advice at least gets to the President, whether or not he takes it. That got to be a very real concern to me toward the end of my term, when I felt that as Mr. Nixon was progressively retreating into his shell under the impact of Watergate, and that Henry Kissinger had de facto seized control of the White House, that I had to assert my statutory responsibility, and I wrote a letter to the president via the Secretary of Defense, but also sent an advance copy to the president, which any sailor or soldier can do, to ensure that the president personally read my advice, because he wasn't getting the military advice in those last few weeks of his presidency.
At what point in Nixon's tour of duty as president was he at the time you received your original appointment?
I was appointed on the 1st of July of 1970, and he came into office in January of that year, or was it the previous year, 1969? See, the election's run...
Well, your 4 years then covered his four-year term, so you really didn't have the trauma of sitting there during his most difficult...
I lapsed over into the first part of his second term. I left office about 6 weeks before he was ejected.
He had, as I'm remembering, he had a rather exhilarating re-election.
That's right.
By a large majority, and that had to be a high point in his life.
Carried everything but Massachusetts and the District of Columbia.
Then the chips all began to fall around him. But you had since then finished your four-year term.
No, he was reelected in January, sworn in January of the year that I left, the following July. So I had 6 months left.
But I need to let those listeners who may have just joined us know that they're listening to KCOK, Tulare and Kings County's only news talk radio, and that this is County Roundtable. I'm your host, Don Hillman, and my guest today is Admiral Elmo R. Zumwalt, known to many of us as Bud Zumwalt, making a return visit to his hometown on the occasion of the reunion of his class, and has been to Rotary Club and other places here, and now visiting with us on County Roundtable. But I heard, I wasn't able to attend the Rotary Club to hear your remarks there, but I rushed out here afterwards and heard the tape of your remarks, because we carried that event live. And I was reminded once again by you that you're a Democrat, and I think back when you and I were barely teenagers, and Herbert Hoover was entertained in your home. You know, and I was really surprised when I heard some years ago that Bud was a registered Democrat. Did this happen after you left the service and became interested in, once again, in partisan politics?
Yes, you're absolutely right. My folks were dyed-in-the-wool Republicans, and I.
Your dad ran for Congress once, did he?
That's right, as a Republican. And I thought of myself as a Republican until I went into the Navy. You're, of course, required to be nonpartisan during those years. When it came to the end of my term, because of what we were just talking about, namely my strong opposition to the Republican administration then in office, primarily because of the way in which Henry Kissinger's philosophy was, I thought, leading us slowly down to disaster, I concluded that I must oppose that administration and therefore became a Democrat. I had one other element to my thinking, and that was it had been my observation that most senior military, almost without exception, ended up going into the Republican Party. And the Republican Party, therefore, had the benefit of their experience and their insights, and the Democrats didn't. It seemed to me that it would be useful to have someone of senior military persuasion kind of having some influence inside the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, at the Democratic National Convention in 1976, I was asked to present the defense platform for the Democrats and was able to interpret it in the most favorable light from my persuasion.
Would we refer to Admiral Zumwalt, USN retired, as being a conservative Democrat? Is that where you see yourself in the political spectrum?
Yes, I think so. I've always called myself a Jackson Democrat. I think that Scoop Jackson, whose loss I feel is a very tragic loss to the country, stood for very much the same kind of things I did. He was liberal with regard to integration of the races and the sexes, and very tough when it came to national security and foreign policy issues.
When you were still Chief of Naval Operations, I think probably, unfortunately, everything seems to fall into a classification of liberal or conservative.
Right.
I would think that probably you were interpreted as being a liberal Chief of Naval Operations because of your innovative ideas with regard to some of the Navy traditions that time seemed to have eroded.
Right. Primarily, Don, the struggle and the controversy had to do with efforts to integrate the Navy. You know, President Truman directed integration racially in the services when he was president. The others did, and the Navy continued to practice tokenism. We had less than 1% of our officer corps of minority background. Less than 5% of our enlisted community were of minority background, although we should have had 11 or 12%. And I just came to the conclusion that it was time, 200 years after this country was founded, for the Navy to be truly representative of the country.
I know a lot of old chief warrant officers and others had trouble adapting themselves. You know, you spend 20 or 30 years doing certain things a certain way, it's hard to make that adjustment. But most of those innovative changes have stayed with it, and the Navy carries, to your credit and certainly to the advantage of the Navy, a lot of the changes you had made. Earlier in our discussion this morning, you have made reference to Kissinger with less than great enthusiasm detected. The fact he's now back in a role, at least in the Central American policy making, of concern to you?
No, I think that it's probably a brilliant choice. What the president needs here is someone who is highly intelligent and who is slippery enough and Machiavellian enough to bring together a lot of polarized thinking. I would only worry about him if he returned to a policy position, because I know firsthand that his view is the Spenglerian view of the United States, namely that, as he puts it, the Soviet Union is the rising imperial empire, that the United States is a civilization which has passed its historic high point and is on the wane, and that his job as Secretary of State was to preside over the smooth transition into inferiority. And I so strongly believe that he is in error that I have made it a point to fight him at every turn with regard to that philosophy.
So as long as he retains this kind of advisory task force, apparently with short-term assignment, you're not concerned. But if he emerges, perhaps later as Secretary of State, you would be.
I would consider that disastrous for the country.
That kind of a thing doesn't seem to come through for those of us who have to glean it out of the media. Obviously, you have dealt with Henry Kissinger one-on-one and observe him on a very close basis. Is that, am I just not listening right, or is this the media's interpretation tends to blunt this very kind of thing that you're expressing concern about?
It's the latter, Don. Henry is a master at stroking and manipulating the press. I think even he would admit that. The quote that I just gave of his philosophy is something that he's always said privately and has never said publicly. Indeed, he denies publicly that he ever said it. However, enough people have heard him say it that it has no real credibility in my judgment, including members of the press who have heard him say it off the record and therefore couldn't quote it. So the problem that the media had is that when he was in office, he would never let that line of thinking be quoted. And he was such a good news source and officer in charge of so many of the leaks upon which the media lived that he got very favorable press.
Mm-hmm. And in our dialogue, we've gotten involved in the issues and people, and I've overlooked a couple of things I wanted to be sure to touch bases on. First of all, tell the ladies who run both your Virginia office and the Milwaukee office how much I appreciate their help. They were genuinely concerned and most helpful.
They knew we were old friends of a lifetime. Huh?
So I take it that you and Musa still make your home in Arlington,
yes,
Virginia?
That's correct. I only took this relatively full-time assignment on 5 weeks ago, and since it is an interim thing, we continue to try to get back to Arlington for the weekends.
And you have your home there. And Lenny, the charming young lady that I have talked to, is you have an office of your own there to kind of keep your own files and papers,
right,
and take care,
right,
of your correspondence.
And to continue to be the root of everything else I do, because this new incarnation is just an interim thing.
You accepted some other assignments between the time that you retired from the Navy and the time that you became involved with this medical buildings firm. Again, what's the name of it?
American Medical Buildings, Inc.
Okay. One of those had to do with educational circles. Weren't you involved with a university or college?
Well, I have served as a visiting professor at a number of colleges, Don. I went down twice a semester to Vanderbilt University for nearly a year and a half. I served as the, you should forgive the expression, the Richard M. Nixon scholar at the Whittier College for some 5 or 6 weeks. I've also served for anywhere from 2 days to a week at several other colleges. It's something that both Musa and I have done. Musa has also served as a lecturer at some of these colleges, and we enjoy it as a break from the business side of the things I'm doing.
And you took a flyer at elective office,
yes,
1.2.
Yes, I was nominated to be the Democratic candidate for the Senate from the state of Virginia, and ran against an unknown chap named Harry F. Byrd, Jr., who, with his father before him, had a 43-year incumbency in the Senate.
You couldn't have gotten a name that had any greater recognition, could you, as an opponent?
I used to say that running against the Byrds was driving down the Harry Flood Byrd Highway to Richmond, or flying into the Richard E. Byrd Airport, and that every city south of the Rappahannock was a Byrd sanctuary.
Probably you also found that the environment of the military, as compared to the environment of running for office, was an abrupt change too, wasn't it?
It was, Don, in a shocking way. Good Democrats who wanted to see me win in the state would come up to me after almost every speech and say, "Bud, you've just simply got to be less clear and precise. You've got to be fuzzier. You're losing one half of the fanatics on each issue by taking a stand. You've got to let both sides think you're for them." And I found that after a lifetime of being clear and precise, I just didn't want to unlearn it.
Well, I think there are a lot of people who are thankful that you maintained your principles. And I think that brings us pretty well up to date. Knowing that you were going to be with me today, I've had a lot of listeners call in and say, be sure to get the Admiral's response on this and this. Let's start. They all want to know, of course, what you think about the President. And I'm going to let that go for a minute because some of it may be reflected as we deal with specific issues. One of the things that shocked us all just recently is the downing of the Korean Airline, Flight 007. And we've heard all kinds of interpretations of what they thought prompted that kind of apparently irresponsible response from the Soviet Union or their representatives. What's your interpretation of this event?
I believe, Don, that there's absolutely no doubt that after the previous penetration of the Soviet Union by a Korean commercial liner in 1978, the Soviet military was so embarrassed that they issued directives that in the future any airliner would be interfered with before it penetrated the Soviet Union. Nevertheless, it's also quite clear from the intelligence gathering that Moscow had a good 2 hours to make the decision as to whether or not to leave that policy outstanding or to instead take a more humane attitude toward it. It's clear that they knew it was a commercial airliner. It's an absolute falsehood, their construct, that this was an intelligence gathering mission.
Do you attach this feeling to the fact that they are trained people and they know those things, or there was something in the intercepted that led credence to that? Or
I think that certain aspects of the intercepted communications show that they knew what it was, and I don't think there's any doubt about what the experienced pilots knew when they saw it, what it was. I believe that at Moscow level, the politicians decided that, one, they were not going to be embarrassed by penetration, and two, this was a good opportunity by a brutal act to frighten Prime Minister Nakasone of Japan, who has worried him because he's moving closer to the U.S. With regard to defense relationships, and that it was also an opportunity to frighten the president of South Korea, whose attitude they don't take kindly to.
So this, we have eliminated all the trigger-happy pilot concept. This was a calculated decision, talking in terms of 2 hours calculation.
In my judgment, it clearly was.
There have been rumors about that, of course, prompted by the Soviets themselves, saying that there was more to that flight than a simple movement of civilians from Anchorage to wherever they were headed. Do you discount all this too? There was nothing to that flight?
In my judgment, there was absolutely nothing to it. No intelligence gathering mission would ever have been set up that way. We get information which is so much superior to what any commercial airliner could pick up through our satellites that it would have been foolish for us to do that. It was clearly a case of human error in putting the wrong inputs into the navigational equipment and very sloppy attention to those instruments because they missed several checkpoints along the way.
One of the surprising things satisfying initially, but then as you think about it, maybe alarming, was the chance that all of us had as civilians to find out